Hey, everybody, welcome to another week of Shop Talk Show. We are going old school this week, analog style, just see how it goes style. It's episode number 205. It's going to be a rapid fire show. That's right, where Dave and I just answer some questions. We always have quite the grab bag of questions in here. You know, I thought at some point in our history that we could like answer every question that we got. It hasn't been the case, but we're closer than you might think. You know, I bet we've answered a heck of a lot more questions than have languished, you know, and especially when we try and pick new interesting ones rather than kind of the FAQ stuff that we get all the time. So anyway, we're no guests, no drama, no, you know, jokes. I don't know. We're going to get into questions right away. I have some sponsors for you. We have Hack Reactor. Thanks so much, Hack Reactor, for sponsoring this week. It is a intense 12-week training and mentorship program. It has been called the Harvard of coding schools, which I kind of like. We're going to tell you more about how that goes down later in the show. And we have FluentConf coming up in March to San Francisco. Get the big picture and the fine details on all things web-related at Fluent. This is your last opportunity to use coupon code SHOPTALKS, plural, to save 30% on that one. Again, we'll tell you more about it later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off, Mr. Dave. Into the grab bag of questions here that we have on Chop Talk Show. this is a kind of an old one. I like going to the bottom of the file sometimes to pick ones that we just hadn't got to that have been sitting here, and then we'll pick some brand new ones too. But Victor Iverson writes in. Dave, you ready for this?
I'm on it.
Okay. He has an internship at a company that makes websites for smaller clients, you know, as many of us do. When the clients are a bit older, they tend to like websites with fixed width, small fonts, about 12 pixels big, and so on. How could I make them understand that the web is moving forward and their websites should too? I know the websites I make is not for me, it's for them, but it feels a bit strange. So what do you do if you have this client and they say, this is the aesthetic I want? See this? I'm showing you some other website I like. This is what I like. And it's some like old school website with like tiny fonts and stuff on it. Like, should you just be like, sir, yes, sir, I will create this website for you? Or is it not like that so much?
I think you got two options. Ready? Okay. Here's my hot take.
Yep.
Two options. Number one, don't care, and your life is probably going to be super good. Like, just code it and let it out the door. And then when you're in charge, you get a bigger font size. Or step two, do user testing and intentionally get somebody who is over the age of 35 or so.
Yeah, and that's weird. In the question that they say the older people like the older sites with tiny fonts. I'm like, usually it's the opposite of that, isn't it? That, you know, like without being like ageist or anything, but you know, as you get older, eyesights tend to go and people prefer things with larger fonts. So,
yeah, I mean, it could be those people like zoomed in their browsers in 1998 and it's stuck at 170%.
I always am reminded of the classic like designer mantra that's like, you wouldn't like tell your plumber that they're installing your sink wrong or whatever. When they hired you as a design expert. So in your expert opinion, you can do the thing. Now, if you give them your expert opinion and they say, no, I want it this way anyway, I don't know. Maybe you're in the business of just saying yes to that and taking their money. I don't know. It's not the end of the world. But yeah, I mean, you're the expert. I would, if you're 100%, you know, convicted in your expert opinion that the fonts should be bigger than they want them, then maybe you make your case for that. And if you lose it, you lose it.
I think there's some typographical stuff. I mean, if like don't violate or try to stick in that, what is it, 40 to 45 to 60 CPL. That's pretty good for reading, I hear. So you could probably have some typographical evidence to support your case, but you know, it's a website. Like, I don't know. I read this Japanese article that, and maybe I can find it one day, but this Japanese article that they did an A/B test in the 12-point font converted better than the 14-point font or something. Yeah. And it's just like, it's just, I don't know. It's just like A-B
tests. At what point does that need to be statistically relevant? You know, was it like thousands of people? You always got a question. Like, we tested two people and the first person said they liked it better. So, you know, anyway, you know, I know Melanie has a good point in the chat too. Like it's weird that we have to empower designers to do the job that they're hired to do. That feels a little weird. And let's, you know, start feeling a little bit more powerful in your job. I think that would feel good. Let's do another one. We got, Cody Darst wrote in. I've always wanted to ask you this. I love SVG. I love how simple and small the files can be. I'm not a designer, though. I'm a developer of all sorts, but I know my designer works really hard on the graphics. Given that SVG files are kind of raw, it's much easier to take bits and pieces of it versus a PNG, which is get what you get. Are you worried that people will come along and steal parts of the SVG file? So because, you know, you can find some SVG, go in there and grab the code, you kind of have this kind of like original in a sense. You have like the vector art that created that thing. Have you ever kind of considered that, Dave?
Have I ever stolen somebody's SVG and changed it and then showed it to them and bummed them out?
Never.
Yes.
Never.
Yes, I have. And I apologize, Jason Santa Maria.
I remember that. Oh, the A Book Apart. Oh, yeah.
There is a thing. It is a deal, and you know, but in the same way that your words aren't protected, you know, or your images on your Tumblr aren't protected. You know, people steal things on the internet all the time because no one understands copyright. That's not to say it's right or good, but for me, it solves a fidelity thing. You know, for your, let's say your logo, you know, you want that to be good and look good in every browser and crisp. And this is going to sound so silly in 5 years. Anyway, I'm just like listening to myself in the future, but the, you want your logo to be good and you kind of don't care if people take it and riff it, you know, or just put it on their site and it looks good on their site. I think the problem is, you know, the like over optimization of images could actually make you look ugly on it if it got stolen. But if it's your artwork, let's say it's your comic or, you know, I mean, if
it's client work. I feel like Jessica Hish has had some points on this that I can't remember to I can't channel her exactly in what she said, but I have a feeling that like Jessica Hish puts tons and tons of time into some beautiful hand lettered thing and it ends up all being vector. There's pretty low chance that she's going to put that original vector on her site in her portfolio. It just doesn't like feel right. You know, it's like, that's like original artwork that you probably wouldn't. But if it's just your logo, you want somebody to steal it in a high format so that when they reuse it, it looks good again, or like it's for artwork that you don't really care that much about. I do think of it in context of the Noun Project a lot, because I use and download tons of stuff from the Noun Project and then use it just wherever, you know, and it ends up being like you could find one that I used pretty much wholesale from Noun Project and use it without paying for it. It's like, gosh, I, you know, even though I'm trying to abide by their licensing or whatever, I'm not exactly sure how that all works. It's mostly just my own ignorance. So
the way I understand the Noun Project is similar to how Madonna wants her name in the pre-roll of the movie to be like 65% of the screen. I think that's how the Noun Project works. Like when you load the site, there has to be a pre-roll that's like icons by John Simpson.
Anyway, that it is interesting. I mean, if you for some actually legit reason need to protect the original vectors of something, I guess SVG would be a problem for you. But I think the cases for that are fairly rare. Arnie Sanders writes in, I have learned and have been using Gulp, and it's a great tool. It compiles CSS files, concatenates, minifies JavaScript. Very helpful. One tiny problem is that when I have to concatenate JavaScript files, I have to list the file paths inside the gulp file. Not like in SAS, where you usually just list file paths in one separate file full of at imports. Is this really how it's supposed to be done, or did I just miss something? Do you know of any other way to concatenate JavaScript while keeping a list of JS paths out of the gulp files? You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know what Arnie mean? So, yeah. So, let's say you kind of the way to do it is you can, you know, you have like a var scripts equals, and then you have an array, like the angly brackets or the bracket brackets. And then you have, you know, quote this file JS, right. jQuery JS, fitvids JS. And it's nice to have like specific paths, but it does sort of like get, you know, cumbersome, especially if you're trying to just hop into a project. There's this thing called the glob selector. Are you familiar with this? */*.js.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, just like grab everything that's .js. I guess that makes sense. Or like just load this whole directory is essentially what it's saying. Although it's saying load this directory of anything in that directory that ends in .js, you know, like a catch-all kind of selector. But how do you control source order then? Can you just not? Or do you have to like name them in order? 1-2-?
1-2-, yeah. That's the thing. You can't control source order. So jQuery kind of has a thing like a convention, naming convention, where it's like jQuery.fitvids or something. But, you know, did everyone adhere to that? No. Are you using Bower? Yeah, maybe. Are you using, you know, but I wouldn't like just siphon in all of your Bower components or something like that. That's, you're going to have like a 30,000 line file. So yeah, I think, I don't know. I think be kind of explicit. You can also like do like a third party directory and a mylib directory or whatever you want to do, and then do the third party directory */*.js, and then mylib directory /*/.js. So that way your like third party dependencies will load before your little code layer on. And Casey in the chat room is saying, doesn't Webpack Browserify solve this issue?
Or like require JS or whatever. Like, it just depends on what your stack is like.
That's just like using a require statement, and it kind of uses Node's common JS pattern to figure out what file you're talking about. And that's, I mean, that's good too. I just played with Webpack recently, and it's got a learning curve, I won't lie. But
yeah, it seems like the learning curve is a little higher than just like, please concatenate these files. You know, like that's like very easy to reason about. You know, you're like, okay, it's these files. You're squishing them together. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's the thing I like about Gulp is you can just be as like generic or explicit as you want. So yeah, good luck. Source like execution order is tough. So
Jason Sunday writes in, I'm going to college for web design and development in Salt Lake City. I'm doing a lot of web projects. Sometimes I run into problems with how I have wrote the HTML and CSS in a way that makes it hard to position a div, for example. What are some best practices when coding the HTML and CSS so that the page comes together in an efficient and predictable manner? So Jason is just, I think he's just like getting started with HTML and CSS and then maybe writes some stuff and gets frustrated with what he wrote or whatever, or is like, I don't know, maybe having a head banging CSS is hard kind of moment.
Yeah, it's tough. Maybe can you come up with an example, like a
concrete? Right. Seems like
struggling here.
Although it seems like the final thing is like, you know, like I think this is like something like Bootstrap is the kind of thing that's going to appeal to Jason early on, I think, where it's just like very prescriptive over what the HTML looks like. It's like, oh, I want this type of component, copy this HTML, put it here, and it will make that kind of component. I think that's like, you know, I'm looking for an efficient and predictable system for HTML and CSS. I think that will probably do you well, Jason, especially in this kind of early learning stages. Not that you should kind of give up on learning this kind of thing, but it's like, I know what you mean. If you're just like, I can't get this div to go where I want, you know, it's just because you just, you know, you don't know enough about HTML and CSS yet, frankly. And so,
yeah, I think like the time honored solution is look at other people's code, look what they did, see if that inspires you to do something or if that solves your problem. You can pick up conventions. I don't know. Is it kind of the like staring at a blank canvas problem, you know, like you're just like, what do I do?
Good luck, Jason. You know, without like a specific case, it's hard to give you any direction on what kind of thing went wrong or what was particularly frustrating to you. That is what's very interesting. It's like, what was it? What was the moment right before Jason decided to go to shoptalkshow.com/ask and type this into there? Because there was probably a moment and we just don't know what it was.
I mean, you kind of had that recently this week, or you're playing with React and you like made a React thing and then you put it out there and you're just like, I made this. Here's my questions, right? That's a good way to do it.
Speaking of that, this is very related. Stefan Cord wrote in something that frequently comes up on the show is the recommendation of writing about the web, and specifically writing about things that you've maybe just created or things that you've just learned. The web world has so much going on, and industry has so many amazing writers. How does one find a way to write something different? Is it even worth worrying about? Those two paragraphs to me are at odds. They're, you know, we've talked about this before. It's great to you know, write about something that you just learned. I did it. I wrote some downright embarrassing React code just last week, and I published it because I'm like, I'm just learning how to do this. React is weird. It's straight up weird. It's very different way of kind of thinking about JavaScript. So I'm just going to try and learn it. I'm going to read some stuff. I'm going to follow some tutorials. I'm going to ask for help when I need it. I'm going to document the code as I'm learning it. And I don't have a problem with writing about that stuff. I've been doing it forever. So you know, like, is there a place for that on the web? Yeah. Is there a place for you to do that, Stefan? Absolutely. It doesn't have to be, you know, the web is full of quality writers. It is and it isn't, you know. You don't have to be a, you know, incredible writer to make writing about code not perfect. And I have encouraged it all over the place. And speaking of React specifically, there was just a Sarah Drasner article on CSS Tricks that was just like, I made a thing in React. I learned it this week and I made a thing in it and I thought it was pretty cool. And I'm writing about it right at that moment that I learned it.
I think, you know, how would you ever get to that level where you're the super pro writer person if you hadn't like learned how to write and how to kind of learn and write, you know, from the beginning, you know? And so I don't count yourself out. I think, you know, CSS Tricks, Chris, forgive me if I am overstating, but it's just kind of a proof that if you just kind of blog your way through things, it like people will like latch onto it and say, yes, I'm actually having the same problem or I think the same things. So,
right. Mostly, especially if you're humble and you approach it with like, I'm not sure what I'm doing, but this is what I'm trying to do. Any advice for me? When you have when you get that tone right, I think this industry is pretty welcoming. You know, with a tone with a sprinkling of humbleness with it. Huge high five to Hack Reactor. HackReactor.com for sponsoring Shop Talk Show this week. For a while, I was personally counting all the people I know who had went to a coding school and come out of it and changed their life for the better. There was two people I knew, then three, then four, then five. I think I stopped counting. I was meeting people at meetups and stuff at like 15. Literally, people are like, oh yeah, I did that. I'm an engineer now. I love it. I make more money. I'm happier. I have a better job. It's just a better situation for me. It has been said Hack Reactor is the Harvard of the coding schools, which I love, and I don't doubt at all. This is a immersive 12-week program, 800 hours of training, intense training and mentorship. Hack Reactor students graduate as full stack software engineers and expert level JavaScript programmers. It's a unique data-driven approach, helping our students think like software engineers while empowering them with building blocks they need to dissect challenges and teach themselves new skills. You work alone, you work in groups, which I kind of like. You learn them both, you know? Use open source libraries. You build open source libraries. You build real platforms. You know, you learn all kinds of stuff. It's a full stack kind of place, which is great. Upon graduation, a majority of the students transition directly into mid to senior level roles. Right on their homepage of their site, $105,000 average starting salary, which is pretty great. 99% graduate hiring rate. You go to places like Adobe, Groupon, Salesforce. There's a little story in our show notes of Guy Morita who went and explains what he did at Hack Reactor. and it was a pretty impressive thing. And now it says right on here he's an engineer at HipMunk. So congratulations, Guy, and congratulations to you who go check out Hack Reactor and change your own life. Here's one. Victor Berland writes in, I'm facing a problem where I don't have enough clients. How do I get more of them? I don't live in an area with many businesses that I can work for. How can I write a good proposal? Tips and experience. So fairly common question on it. I put this one in there, or it caught my eye in the pile of questions here, specifically because I just read an article this morning by Sarah Parmenter, Sazzy, as you may know from Twitter, and she titled the post "The Elephant in the Room," and the gist of it is that, verbatim from the article, work has dried up. There's apparently an undercurrent of whispering and stuff. You know what I'm saying? That work is a little harder to find, as particularly for the freelancer, the small freelancer type of person. So at least that's Sarah's perspective. And you know, Sarah lives in the UK, but you know, has plenty of US experience and stuff. So maybe I don't know if the situation is international or what, but. What do you think? Is Victor, you know, can Victor find clients anyway? Do we have advice for Victor? Is this systemic?
I think possibly you could be in the, caught in the well drying that Sarah kind of is experiencing and describing. You know, I think it's tough. I don't know, but it does seem like a lot of Squarespace is kind of undercut that lower level of work where you'd probably normally just cut your teeth making websites, you know, and now it's just anyone can make a Squarespace. Can they make a good website with Squarespace? Yes, maybe no. But that's kind of the
probably
new,
too. Here's a anecdotal thing, and this is old. This is an old conversation we've been having on Chop Talk Show forever, and it's been hot drama. And some of the old advice was, I think Dave, you've been that's where the old John Henry stuff came from, wasn't it? It's probably true that there probably is a little work getting eaten up by this, not like all the work in the world, but some kind of thing. And it's just the march forward of how the web is going on. Anecdotally, I just joined a thing local to my community in Bayview, Milwaukee. That's the neighborhood, and it's a letterpress printing thing, and they have memberships, and you join the membership, and you can go in there, and you can use their inks and their letters and the press and stuff, and you can make your own stuff, and it's really, really cool. I've been taking classes, and I'm working on a new thing, setting some type and printing a poster, and I'm really excited about it. They just rocked a Squarespace site. Looks great. Works great. You know, it's just like, it seems like it's something that would have been a client for somebody at one point, but they're just like, you know what, this is easy enough. And even though we're not web people, we're, you know, intelligent people that can figure things out, and they just rocked it. At the same time, there's like little, like awful frustrating things in there. Like when I book studio time for the thing, I have to book it like it's like any other product, like it's a t-shirt or something, and then check out. And then even though it's $0 because I'm a member anyway, it has to like correct my credit card information. And I have to like agree to sign up to the newsletter every single time. So it's one of those things where it's both the greatest thing ever that happened for them because it was cheap and it was easy for them to create. And it also has all these little frustrating little problems that you wouldn't have got before because it would have, it's like a professional could have like helped you solve these design problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's that thing that can the machine do my job a little, you know, just as good or whatever, or as good as 50% of the people who do my job. I think the answer is probably yes, they can. Like they can probably, you know, kind of build a pretty good website, but it's that other like 20% that makes the details, that makes a difference, you know? The sign in or the registering a free class for you, you have to put your credit card in. That's like very, very silly, you know? I think, I think that's like part of the problem. I think the other sort of side of the coin is all the large companies, like the big box retailers, the, you know, California brand new startups, brah. They are, you know, they have money and funding and everything. And so they're trying to bring things in house so that they can do things without the use of consultancies outside of the company. So I think that's an issue as well. I think that's a very, kind of real thing that's happening. And I think in Sarah's post, she was saying they like promoting internal people to web projects, who don't know anything. It's just like, hey, you look like you like computers. You should make a website, make our, you know, big box retail website. And that's such a just interesting slash, I don't know, the higher projects are like the higher end are all being brought in house. And Sarah kind of pointed out like this big retailer just found people in their organization and were like, hey, you like websites, you should be the website person. Not necessarily because they had experience or training or anything. So, that's just a very interesting dynamic. So I guess back to the original question, what were we talking about?
Victor was just saying like, well, what could I do to get more work? I feel like what you could do, Victor, is fairly obvious. I mean, not to undermine the question, but like be good, have a really good looking website, treat your existing clients really well so that they do good word of mouth for you. I mean, some of this stuff is fairly obvious. Like if you're great, you know, you're going to have an easier time getting more work. It's just kind of the way it is. Mitch Jackson writes in, how do you handle small styles? For example, three lines of code in SaaS. Do you create its own partial or do you create one called global and put it in there? It was a small question, but it's one of those things like where you kind of wish you could like be looking over Mitch's shoulder when he decided to write this thing. So, you know, let's say you really do have like three lines of code that are, you know, very specific to one page. Like your about page is like, it has one little thing on it that's different for the rest of the site. Do you make an about.css and make it as like a partial that you pull into global? Do you make it as a totally separate file that you link up separately? Or do you just be like, screw it, I'm just going to put it in the global styles with everything else?
I think the atomic design way is to split every line of code into its own CSS partial. Am I wrong on there? if it's just a very, I think it makes sense. Is it something that's a component, you know, does it make sense to abstract it? And there's actually, I've been reading some posts about, object orientation and monoliths and microservices and everything. And I think it all kind of applies, to CSS as well. But it's that thing, if you make it too micro, it doesn't do enough, you know? So you need like 10 micro things to do one thing. And then no one knows what each micro thing does. And so later on, people will just write their own code anyway. It's kind of this disposable code movement. Have you heard of that? It's kind of just treating.
I have not.
It comes from the React people who are shaking things up. I think it's just this idea like treat your code as disposable. It's not this pristine, you know, golden god. It's something somebody's going to mow over the next time they see it. You know, it's like treat all code kind of like that. So you can spend some time making good, you know, modules and architecture, but geez, just, it doesn't, you know, kind of just get the job done as maybe job one. And then, you know, maybe there is a refactor process.
I think of this as
that said, there's the other criticism is like refactoring is awful, you know, cause you don't know what you're going to break, especially with CSS. So, I'm a big fan of really tight components. Like I wish I could reset CSS on every component, and I guess
let's do that one next. But I should say, Mitch, there's this concept where like, what are you talking about where you put it is like, are you talking about where you put it organizationally in your authored code or where you put it like in production code as well? So I think those are kind of two separate questions. Like I find that in production, it generally things are getting more and more smashed together these days. When I was kind of looking at how lots of different companies are writing the CSS kind of at the end of last year, there was like a little rash of like how we do CSS at this company. It was really, really, really common that they just took all the CSS that they write at their entire company and they smash it into one file or possibly two if it's like they run into that weird IE bug where there's too many selectors or something, or maybe just for parallelization or something. But I found that to be really common. Like, take every bit of CSS on every page of everything and just smash it together and just serve that, and that's the CSS. So then the question becomes, where are you putting it organizationally? Sure, if it makes sense to have a partial, fine. If it makes sense to make a little code comment and say, oh, this chunk of code right here, this goes along with this and that works for you too, fine. It's like that part isn't as interesting to me. So however matches your mental style. Now, speaking of what Dave was just talking about, Justin Hammonds writes in, I find CSS modularization very intriguing. Would like to view great examples of project implementing style building entirely in this way. In the JavaScript, he's interested in too. Could you port me to some good open source examples? So you know, this is similar to the, you know, doing styles in JavaScript React thing, although I don't think React is required for that, but there's just this sense of that. But then there's CSS modules is like a thing too. That's like the Glenn Mattern thing, or at least he's like kind of involved with it. Have you seen that too? If you Google CSS modules, it comes up right away. It's kind of a thing where like it's JavaScript based, but it like, I think it like scopes all the CSS that you write in like a really kind of weird throwawayable kind of way so that the styles only affect that particular module. So the idea being that like some people are like so opposed to the fact that CSS is global, and that's where all the dangers of CSS come from. So what if things were more like web components? What if the styles I write were like isolated to this little thing, and nothing from the outside can come in and screw it up, and nothing from the inside can go out and screw up other things? I think that's where the like impetus for this comes from. Is that appealing to you?
I'm looking at it. I suppose, but I don't know. No, this is not what I want. Sorry. I got to the bottom of the article and it's like, nope. I think is it all unset or property? Are you familiar with that?
Oh, right. There is like an all initial, or I don't know what it is, but it does. It's just like immediately it stops the cascade kind of into that world. And it's as if you have a little box now in which there's no styles. I kind of forgot about that.
Yeah. Well, and it works in Chrome 41, Firefox 27 and Edge, but not Opera and Safari. So, it might make it into Safari in the year 2020. So, maybe we can use it, but it's going to really mess up older rendering engines. So that's very unfortunate. I'm not sure where I land. I think there's so much to, you can accomplish a lot with just saying, you know, BEM style, base element modifier, or whatever style you want to kind of invent. I think there are things like atomic framework or some whatever that's called. I think, you know, that's like x-s-apgmby, and I think that takes it a little bit too far because you need like a decoder to understand what it's trying to say. BEM is probably sits pretty right, but I don't know. I also think of themes, like you want the just a blue button, or maybe that's called a modifier. But I just when you're like doubling modifiers, that's weird too. Okay,
it seems like there's a lot of tech that gets put into like, I don't know. I personally haven't felt the pain that tools like this are born out of. It feels like there's a lot of like somebody like is working on some app and they're just butt hurt. They're just like, CSS is the worst. And I've just never been in that position. So it's hard for me to empathize in the right way with some of these tools. You know, I'm just like, I don't know. That's what a style guide is for. That's what atomic design is for. That's what like, I don't know. I guess I just have this like CSS ain't that hard kind of mentality. yeah. which is perhaps unfair. But
well, and whenever people are like, oh, the problem with CSS is it only grows. Have you heard that one? You've heard that one.
Yeah, and well, that, you know, it's there's like, some evidence
where,
of that.
Where do you work where code doesn't just grow? Like, where do you work where code just magically disappears and gets better over time? I've never seen that. I don't know. That's so such a silly argument. There's lots of silly arguments. I think so much can be done with naming. I think start there, like a really good naming system. Somebody was showing me, I'm dropping the ball here. Somebody showed me a pretty decent naming system recently. I wish I could recall it. I'm blanking right now, but anyway.
I want to see it too, because Justin has written here, like, I want to see some projects. I want to see some live websites that are doing this and they're successful at doing it. There's a lot more talk than there are live websites. You know, you want to see a website that's using CSS successfully? Look at any website. You know, there's like lots of, you know, like there's lots
every
of websites.
Every website is proved. Currently leveraging CSS right now.
Yes, right. And there's like, and every time like inline styles comes up or whatever, it's like, oh, really? You're doing that? Oh, yeah, we are. But it's like this secret client thing that launches next year or something. It's like, you know, like, let's see them. Let's see the examples of this solving problems for real. It seems like a lot of, no, I don't know. I guess we're having an argument that may not actually exist, but. Hey, Fluent is coming up. That is O'Reilly's Web Platform Conference coming up March 7th through 10th out in San Francisco. This, my friends, is your last chance. Use the coupon code SHOPTALKS for ShopTalk to hook you up to save a heaping chunk on your registration for attending FluentConf. That's 30% off. Again, ShopTalks, plural. Web programming design, making it great. That is what FluentConf is all about. 2 days of intense training at the beginning for people who want a tight focus on things like React. Oh, React, so awesome. Node, CSS layout, or planning a site, followed by sessions exploring everything from foundation design decisions to the details of JavaScript workflows, the latest JavaScript frameworks, chat hardware, cultures that make these projects succeed or fail. Beyond the sessions even, Fluent's developer community lounge, lunch tribe tables, an Angular 2 meetup, many opportunities for conversations with your peers. For just $99, if you want to just go to Fluent and like check out the expo and like hang out with people and stuff, $99 for that. So you can still check out Fluent for that. You'll come back with a big picture of where web development is headed and the details you need to make it work for you. So yeah, check out Fluent, subscribe, pay, go. Stay in San Francisco, March 7th through 10th. It's going to be awesome. This is probably an old one, but it's kind of related to this. Jitendra Vyas, who sends us questions pretty regular, is jQuery still the best library for DOM manipulation? It would have been yes for a long time, probably. I mean, that's what jQuery is and does. It has some AJAX methods and some animation methods, but I think people mostly reach for it for its because Sizzle's built in and it's such a great, you know, selector library, and the DOM manipulation is strong in jQuery, but these days it's starting to move on a little bit. So if you're looking for a DOM thing, React is really worth looking at. You know, I am like a couple weeks into like a straight up trying to learn it, and I think it's cool as snot.
I just made a universal React app where it renders on the server and the client.
No way.
Hotness. It's fun. I think we talked about this a long time ago. I was talking about building Daytrip, right? Maybe we didn't talk about this on the show, but we got a bunch of user feedback and it was like, I hit these buttons and the page refreshes. I hate this. Like, the form should submit AJAX style. It's
right.
Like, okay.
I mean, I was just feeling that pain on CSS tricks because what I was working on I was making a little commenting component on CodePen, and I worked a bunch with it and tried different styles and whatever. And it was, you know, you get used to like testing it and hitting the button and seeing the comment appear immediately there. And then I get so used to that because that's how it works on CodePen itself. And that's how it works on like a discuss site and stuff. And then I go to poor old CSS tricks, just running stock WordPress and hit the button and just watch it chug to reload the page for the comment to be there. I'm like, okay, this really does feel kind of old school. But yeah, I know what you mean.
No, well, and that's the it. I think like you, if you don't have that richness, I think you're behind the curve is kind of where I'm getting. Right. Like we had users asking, and so I started building out these AJAX requests for it, and you know, Rails actually makes it kind of easy. They have like a data remote thing, and it'll go and then send, and then you have to configure your server to send the proper response, and that's okay too, but. And then you have to kind of figure out what you're going to do when you get the response. Do you add a class? Do you re-render a whole new thing? And I started like coding out these buttons, and each button kind of had to do a little different thing. And I'm like at 300 lines of code or something. And I'm just like, I'm not doing this a good way, you know? So I wonder if these things like Ember and React and kind of who are trying to take the client side, kind of like, hey, we do it all. I'm just like, do they do it really well? So I did Wes Boss's course on React, and gosh, if you just need to watch that video that he has like to pitch his website, and it's kind of this like menu that goes all live, and you're like live updating and stuff. And oh my goodness, you just look at it and you're like, I want that. That's what I want it to be. I want that one. So
can look at the, like, go to the, like, you know, state is the key word, right? Like go look at the CodePen editor and just think of all the state that happens there. Like, is the settings open or not? Is any of the given editors, what size are they? Are they open or not? What code is in any of the given text areas? Like, I can tell you on the back end, we deal with state, and it's a big ass object of state. And it's like, how cool would it be if we had written the thing such that, and you know, maybe we'll get to it over time. It's not like the way that I'm not like embarrassed by the current architecture of CodePen. It does plenty of smart things, but it's not currently written in React. And imagine if it was, when all these components are just like ready to accept state. And all we're doing is just managing that state, and in the front end just automatically adjusts to that state. And that's so particularly useful because on like, for imagine Professor view on CodePen, all we do to make that work is just send like diffs to the state back and forth. So it's just like, oh, the state has changed a little bit, go change it here. So like when you're using Professor view, the entire editor looks exactly the same on the when you're watching as what the professor is doing, including like the sizes of the editors and what's open and what not, and what select menus are on what thing, and what checkboxes are checked, and all that kind of stuff syncs. But it's kind of more of a manual process, and it's like that kind of thing, that kind of that React really excels at. So that was kind of a side, but
yeah, I forget the original question, but was it about components?
Do you still use jQuery for DOM?
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah, I do. I actually like, I'm doing a lot of document query selector all, and then dot class list, yeah, dot add or whatever it is, sure. And I get very, very far with that. I'm not sure I need to do anything else. You know, I know that doesn't work in everything, and I could probably find a polyfill for it, but I that gets me very, very far. So I don't do a lot of DOM manipulation. It's mostly to add classes or remove classes or remove elements and, or attributes. And that's all, I don't know. I think that's all it really, I don't know. That's all you need these days. That's what browsers have gotten way better. jQuery is probably overkill for what browsers can do now.
Let's see. James Finn writes in, is there a workflow or tools you would recommend for automated pre-commit code formatting so that everyone who contributes to code has it automatically formatted the same without having to worry about editor config? We use SCSS, JS handlebars, and templates and stuff. So James, I think what he's asking is to like let everybody code however they want to, and then when it's committed, it formats the code correctly. That seems like a weird approach to it. I've never seen that approach. I don't know that it's impossible, but it kind of just seems like, I don't know, just have a standard and tell people to adhere to it, and that's what editor config is for. So.
Yeah, there's a few like lines of defense. You have the editor config, which I think most editors basically respect to some, or can
Right.
You know, and that should like do indentation and maybe.
And that's like a dot file, right? It just sits at the base level of your project. And for example, Sublime Text will see that file and be like, oh, I see in this project, in this directory and all of its subdirectories, any code that's open, this is kind of a two spaces kind of project. This is, you know, it has information about what is expected to be formatted in here. So it's not like up to you to configure your editor on a per project basis for what the style is, because you could very easily be working on two different projects that have two different opinions about, like, for example, what sizing or how many spaces and all that type of stuff.
Yeah. There's some tools for like CSS and there's some tools for JavaScript too that will like grunt tasks that will like beautify or kind of set it in a predictable way.
So would you want pre-commit hook doing that? It seems so weird to me to have a computer be like, oh, here's the code you just wrote. I'm just going to like run it through this thing though quick before I commit it. You know, like, don't touch the code I wrote. That's not fair. And what if it's white space dependent? What if it's Jade or something? Could mess with it.
Yeah, well, I think the person who wants it is the person who gets very upset if a curly bracket isn't in the wrong place. I think that the idea is on a large team, when you hop into a project, you should all like, you should all not like, no one should be like tinkering with formatting, kind of like, oh, I had to reformat your file and now there's 800 diffs here and on this file or something. So, because that can actually affect the commit too, right? Like the strip trailing white space. Like you open something and then it just like rips it out of every file in the project. And like, so when I go to commit my CSS change, I commit 800 files.
Yeah.
Who's done that before?
Me. I'm pretty bad at that actually. Like I'm happy to like have a commit that should be like one line of change and you should be able to look at it and understand what I was doing in that commit, but there's actually three other files there because there's little things I was correcting elsewhere, which is a really bad habit, because at least what you should do is separate those into two commits, one of them being like a pedantic little blah commit and one of them being the actual thing that you're fixing. But
let us know what you use in the comments, because I'm just blanking on every repo that would ever do this. So but there's yeah, you should just, I don't know, just if you're working with other people and somebody wants it, give in. Just say yes. Let's do something. Let's be consistent. So anyway, all right. What's next, Chris? Are we?
This is a weird. Almost out of time? Well, okay. Let's do like two more or something.
Two more. Got it.
This is one that's it's a little cringy, I guess. My question relates to Johnny Cates. We're using a master CSS file to compile a bunch of partial CSS into a minified master CSS file for use in production. Okay, we're using CodeKit to run this task on the fly. CodeKit watches for whenever a partial is touched, and then we'll recompile the master file. All good so far. We've done this, right? Our issue is that we are syncing our development style sheets in a folder across our team using Dropbox. This means that any edits Mrs. Developer X makes to the SCSS partials are automatically synced to everyone's local machine when the file is saved and our master CSS file gets recompiled. So you could just be sitting there doing nothing. Dropbox syncs a file. CodeKit sees that the file has changed and it gets recompiled. It's possible, therefore, that Mr. Developer Y will then push the master CSS file to our staging environment before Mrs. Developer X has really finished her work on that particular partial. So it sounds like Dropbox is a little too real time for this.
Yeah. I've done this Dropbox-driven development. stay tuned for my book on a book part. I've done Dropbox-driven development. It's actually really nice. It's really fun, like especially in the like prototyping phase where you're just like, pew, pew, make things. Yeah, let's all do it. We're all doing it. Yay. And it's all just appearing on your computer like real time. And like you didn't even type anything and all of a sudden it's like, bang, background pink. That's really good. I think that I think everyone should do things different ways, but it's always fun to do that. I think it's good. I think what we've learned really quickly is you have to be very intentional. Like in the Slack chat, you have to be, I am working on whatever article.css. Don't touch it. Like,
you even got to do that in Git sometimes, because it's like not ideal, even at Git, if two people are working on the exact same file up on the same lines and stuff.
Or if, like you didn't have some communication and you kind of were trying to fix the same problem or something, and like you actually did overwrite the same lines of that file. Oh boy. Like, man, that it turns into this like just it's somebody's going to have to spend a half hour, like half hour doing a merge conflict because somebody didn't talk about something, you know? So, so that's, I think, you know, I think that's the thing is like, I'm working on this file. Don't touch until I say touch, you know, so that, but it can also, you know, with the cascade, again, back to the cascade, you can actually, it can get really hard because you could be writing a lot of code to fix somebody else's problem that they're trying to fix live. So, but it's fun. I like Dropbox driven development, but it's not, it's Git is probably better. You're probably, I don't know, slow it down a little bit, make it less real time, maybe.
yeah. And communication is key there, whatever. I mean, there are the good parts about Dropbox is that it really does, you know, it'll, even if you delete a file, you can get it back. It keeps changes of files and stuff. So it's okay. It's just, it's a little fast. I wonder if they'll come out with a product at some point that's like a, you know, slow sync version, on-demand sync.
You know what's even better than Dropbox-driven development at the prototypal stage? CodePen/Glab.
Cha-ching. Thanks. We don't do versions or diffs, but we will someday, I feel like. That's pretty good. Oh,
it's if you just want to play with code with friends, that's the way to go.
Josh Oaken writes in, I'm a new listener, huge fan of the show. Thanks for the great tips and the inspiration and motivation. You're welcome, Josh. I feel like you should type those words into our iTunes rating box after you've clicked 5 stars. I freelance as a front-end web developer and also as an online marketing specialist for small businesses. I provide SEO ranking reports that I show my clients and stuff like that. Do you guys have any suggestions on software options that are reasonably priced for a one-person business that can help automate this process? I'm building up a decent client base and would love to save some time with researching the hundreds of keywords I'm currently tracking. I don't have any idea, Josh. It sounds like what you want to do is like show your client some proof that that like this is where you're at with rankings and stuff, and then you want to like do some work and maybe run those reports again and then show it to them. Have you ever dabbled in that kind of thing, Dave?
Like kind of like SEO tracking kind of stuff.
Yeah, I it seems actually pretty reasonable. Like you might actually like. Well, I would be interested to see those charts, I think, you know?
Yeah, I think it's tough. I think it's also doubly tough. Like Google is, it kind of shows different things based on different people's likings, you know? So you can like have the generic, you know, private browsing mode, you know, version. But that doesn't really, you know, that's just for this weird robot. It's not for you. Like Google kind of tailors it to everyone they know about. So that's, it's kind of a red herring, but I don't know. You could, you could program Phantom.js to do this for you if you wanted to get into kind of some node work, but just drive Phantom to Google, do a keyword search and then take some screenshots. I don't know.
That's so deliciously nerdy. I love it.
That's like $0. I could do that in an afternoon for you. We're probably not the SEO people. We've just talked so long about getting like a super SEO person on the show to like say like tell us how it really works. because that would be really good. Let's see.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's mostly just me being ignorant about what the SEO world is like. I assume there's so much thinking and people and conferences and stuff. I'm sure this question could be well answered by one of those people. I bet tools exist. I bet there's expensive ones. I bet there's good ones. I bet there's bad ones, cheap ones, all that kind of thing. So there is a, There's certainly hope for you, Josh.
Moz, like SEO Moz, they used to be SEO Moz. Now they're just Moz.com. They're kind of my go-to on like SEO tips and kind of current trends. So there you go. Maybe they have a tool. They have a couple of products and stuff that they like. You can track a keyword and you can see your ranking based on your keyword. And there's a little chart for it, and you could send it to your clients, and that might be good. So yeah, try it. Hey. They're kind of my go-to. So, all right. Anything else, Chris?
I think that'll do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. It's always so fun to do these rapid-fire shows. We get to talk about a lot of stuff. And please send in more questions. I love reading these things. Every time I get one in an email, I'm just like, ooh, what does somebody want to talk about now? You know, it's always kind of a pleasurable thing. We should also say that there is shoptalkshow.com/FAQ, which there's just a certain kind of, we're trying to this season do more of these topical-based shows because there's some danger that I've heard from people, and I've kind of taken it to heart that the show can be a little repetitive. There's a lot of questions that come in that are just that fall into that FAQ territory. Should I go to school or not? How do I get more clients? What should I learn next? That kind of stuff that we're specifically trying to avoid a little bit on purpose. So just know that, I guess.
Yeah, I think it'll be fine. So, well, thanks everybody for listening. We really appreciate it. Be sure to vote us up in iTunes. 5 stars is just that easy. That's how people find out about the show in your podcatcher of choice. The Overcast has a little star feature I like to use. And then be sure to follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. That's how you get some good content, tens of tweets a month, and you can even retweet us from there. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new job, because people want to hire you in what you do. And if there's anything else, I gotta kind of go to a thing about it, Chris.
Shoptalkshow.com.